But it is accessible. You can hear all the words for a start, and there's nothing, you know, there's nothing too terribly strange about them. It's the first four or five albums, really, isn't it? That's the man's work. Indeed, it would have been better, really, if he'd have stopped after Clear Spot. The original Magic Band, or certainly the first two or three incarnations of the Magic Band, were absolutely perfect for B-Fart. It was a unit. And who actually wrote what and who played what, I don't know. But that band exactly suited who he was and what he was doing, which was painting with music, basically, but with a very strong rhythmic content and some extremely interesting playing, particularly Zoot Horn Roller, Bill Harkelrod, who's one of the great rock guitarists, and his influence has been felt down through the decades now, and a lot of people play like him today. They've never even heard of him, but that's where they've taken their guitar style from. At Fender style, you know, the Telecaster guitar playing, which was exactly right. Ry Cooda was exactly right to guest on that first album, you know, because that was the jump from traditional blues into the Beefheartian world. Well, I think it's almost impossible to guide anybody like Beefheart. I travelled with him quite a bit. I played cards with him once on a coach coming back from Bradford, came back through Rochdale. I lost 13 quid to him playing blackjack. He used to swallow the mic, and he had 3K foldback on stage, which was more than most bands were putting out front at the time. And it was just deafening. It was like a cement mixer, which is the word the sound man used to me. I was sitting next to the sound desk trying to get the sound right, but Beefheart couldn't hear himself, because when he sings, his ears pop out. Therefore, he turns up the monitors on stage, and the whole thing just becomes a howling wall of feedback, which is just plain bloody stupid. And he just didn't know how to use a mic. If he'd have sung an inch or 2 inches back from the mic, we'd have got a good sound, but we didn't get it. Really wants to be deafened by a screeching wall of feedback when there's, you know, lyrics to be listened to, and musicians who are... That the guy at the desk was sick and tired of being shouted at by Beefheart. He was getting really angry. I saw him doing it several times, and he was shouting and gesturing. The tour manager was a guy they picked up hitchhiking in California. I remember one light that he wanted was Bastard Amber, you know, and he wanted a Super Trooper follow spot, which in those days, I believe, could only be got from the continent. I mean, we just simply couldn't do the lighting requirements. We just had to say no, couldn't do it. And there was a guy called Jonathan Smeaton, who did the lighting for Beefheart on some of his tours, who was rushing around like a maniac to try and get it right, you know. And I think that was Beefheart being deliberately difficult. And a Beefheart show was not about lights, you know. There was no point in going to all that stupid nonsense about hiring in very expensive lighting equipment. It just added to the whole cost with no particular effect. It detracted from it. The reason why a lot of Americans that I've worked with, a lot of Americans that I know, are so very keen on England is that the English audiences take an artist on their merits and they appreciate them for what they are, not because they fit into a safe category. And even after the underground explosion in the 60s, when all kinds of strange stuff was coming through, it still had to be compartmentalised and sold, packaged as a product, which is what they call it in the business. They call an album product. That's what they call it. And of course, Beefheart didn't fit in, and the audiences didn't fit in really with him. He certainly has a following in the States, but I should imagine it's a small cult following, you know. But they treat people differently over there because it's so financially orientated, you know. I mean, the English audience and perhaps the continental audience recognised a genuine talent, a towering talent, an enormous talent, and they were prepared to put up with it. They didn't mind. Well, perhaps they did mind, or they didn't mind the sound and all the rest of it, but they saw through it all and said, look, this man's special, you know, because they understood it, without prejudice, you know what I mean? They didn't have those kind of, if you like, commercial filters, which it seems that the Americans in general, and it was a broad generalisation, seem to need. Otherwise, the greatest American music of all time, blues, well, blues and jazz, but blues particularly, went virtually unnoticed in the States for 50 years. And it hardly ever played on mainstream radio at all. He tried very hard to fit into the mainstream with his two albums for Mercury, which came out over here on Virgin, which were the worst things he ever did by a very long way. He actually apologised to me for those albums, and he apologised to me for his band leaving him, the original Magic Band, who left him when he put those albums out. You know, but in fact it was a career move, quite a deliberate career move to try and broaden out to the mainstream. Well, I don't know. I mean, I've heard that many stories about it that I wouldn't at all be sure. But again, you were talking about parody. the original Magic Band, or certainly the first two or three incarnations of the Magic Band, were absolutely perfect for B-Fart. It was a unit. And who actually wrote what and who played what, I don't know. But that band exactly suited who he was and what he was doing, which was painting with music, basically, but with a very strong rhythmic content and some extremely interesting playing, particularly Zoot Horn Rollo, Bill Harkelrod, who's one of the great rock guitarists, and his influence has been felt down through the decades now, and a lot of people play like him today, they've never even heard of him. That was the jump from traditional blues into the Beefheartian world of fractured blues, if you like. I heard that his wife, Jan, fired the band. You know, whether that's because they'd had an offer which involved just Beefheart with side musicians as opposed to the Magic Band as a unit. It's strange, really, because he didn't present himself particularly well. If he was going to go the popular route, then he didn't do it well. He could have done it a lot better, but he didn't, which is strange. Well, I think it's almost impossible to guide anybody like Beefheart. Well, not that there is anybody like Beefheart, but I just don't think he's the kind of man that takes direction. I think he panics now and again and grabs for the dollar, and somebody might have an influence on him briefly. But then it all goes wrong, you know. And I think he should have had more faith in who he was and his own talent right from the word go. But then, of course, hindsight, it's very easy to look back and say, well, you know, he could have done that there and he could have done that there, and it would have all been a lot better. But at the time, the man was evolving. And I'm just grateful that we've got the, you know, those first four or five albums, which is where his work is for me, rather than the later stuff, which I consider to be largely irrelevant, you know. I think it's like any artist, they go through periods, like Picasso goes through a blue period or whatever, and Beefheart went through his Beefheartian period, then he became this parody that you're talking about, and then he became a very successful artist, you know, so that's the, basically the rhythm of his career has been like that, you know. But you can understand that in the early days, quite simply, the American music business wanted a Rolling Stones. They wanted somebody who could take the blues and twist them a bit, but make them accessible and popular. In fact, at one point, Beefheart actually asked me, he said, where did I get my voice from? And I said, like anybody else would, Howlin' Wolf. He said, no. He said it was Robert Pete Williams with an album called Free Again. If you look at the Safest Milk album, you'll see Grown So Ugly, Robert Pete Williams. He actually wrote it, and that's the original version that's on that album. Grown So Ugly is pure Beefheart, and that's the black original version of it, and that is where Beefheart got his voice and his vocal style from. It comes from that one particular track. It's just, I mean, what we're talking about is an extremely strange artist that happened to arrive in the 1960s who has a very enduring and loyal fan following, you know, and which seems to be handed down now to the second or third generation, because if you go to a record store, most of Beefheart's records are still available, which is a very unique and precious club to belong to, because there are not that many artists you can say that of from the 60s. Apart from the obvious big pop people, Beefheart is there, you know. So he must sell. There must be a continuous demand. Otherwise, it wouldn't be there. And it is there.